Well, two things about that introduction. First of all, when Ted called or emailed me about coming, he said they were really interested in having the finest speaker available to substitute for Rabbi. And inasmuch as they could not find that person, they asked me to come. Yeah. Secondly, I have nowhere else to be today, so I'm pleased to be here, believe me. Yeah. I understand that the rabbi did some things around the Jewish concept of Jesus, what that means, etc. And as I was thinking about how to interface with that without having heard it and without being very knowledgeable really about Judaism, two thoughts came to my mind. First thought came from Tip O'Neill, former Speaker of the House. He once said, "All politics are local." The second thought came from my mentor, Carl Michelson, who once said, "All theology is personal." And I think that becomes clear as we openly talk about our faith, for while it is that our faith is something that comes to us in a sense of tradition, have you noticed how it is also something that becomes shaped within our experience? It's true. Our faith is something that is shaped by the experiences that we have, perhaps the needs that we face, or the strengths that we possess. And there is no point, at least from my thinking, in the Christian faith where that becomes more apparent than in our understanding of Jesus. Over the last 45 years of being privileged to be a part of the organization known as the church, the one thing that's impressed me has been how many different ways Jesus is perceived. And beyond that, therefore, the countless ways in which the perception of Jesus begins to inform how we do our faith in the real world. And so this morning, what I'd like to do is talk about Jesus, the unabridged definition. And I'd like to begin by suggesting that I'm sure Rabbi shared with you how it is that the journey of Jesus across Judaism has been terribly, terribly unique. Certainly began with the Orthodox Hasidic Jew who have not a lot of time for Jesus. But up through the generations, primarily during the Enlightenment with Moses Mendelssohn, that began to change. And Judaism began to recognize Jesus as a teacher and as a prophet. Certainly Martin Buber, the great Jewish writer and theologian of the last century, totally revolutionized Judaism's concept of Jesus by suggesting that there was a special quality about that teacher and that prophet. And of course, Milton Steinberg, who is known as one of the leading Jewish conservative thinkers, has made it very clear that for his practice of Judaism, again, personal experience, Jesus, he uses this word, is very, very unique. So Judaism has gone through this interesting metamorphosis of their understanding of Jesus, and so have we. I believe the Christian faith, and I say this is a good thing, I think Christian faith is constantly understanding, reinterpreting who Jesus was, and more critically, how Jesus impacts the world in which we live. And so today I've selected three theologians who are characteristic of Jesus in process. The first theologian is Karl Barth, probably the leading theological voice of the last century, certainly the most voluminous in terms of writings. I don't know of anyone who is more prolific than Karl Barth. The background of Karl Barth is that he began as a liberal theologian, and that means that he was impressed with the notion that God was immanent. And what that means is that God is everywhere. It's almost a naturalistic kind of philosophy. God is someone or something you can reach out and sort of touch. The second notion about liberal German liberalism of Barth was that sin is just an error in judgment. It has nothing at all to do with moral flaws or moral integrity issues. It's just a lapse of judgment. And therefore, you see, sin can be corrected by good education. The third component of liberalism, as Karl Barth experienced, was this: history, human experience, is increasingly getting better and better and better. And then Karl Barth, serving a little church in Saffenwald, Switzerland, encountered World War I. And suddenly all of the components that he had embraced in liberalism weren't working, because above all else, Karl Barth was a preacher and a pastor. And as he was going on about a God that is close and near and familiar, and as he was talking about sin as an error in judgment, and that this could be corrected by education, that the world was getting better and better, he was having all of these young men coming back from the war who had experienced poison gas. But then again, he was dealing with families who had lost loved ones, and he wrote in his journal, "None of it works." That began a pilgrimage for Karl Barth. He began by studying the book of Romans. And as he studied the book of Romans, he realized that there was something about the way in which Paul addressed the church at Rome that suggested that God was transcendent, and that sin was an issue of the heart, not of the mind, and that history was somewhat cyclical. And as Barth was struggling with the book of Romans, he encountered a man whose name was Adolf Hitler. And as you all know, Hitler usurped the church, and it became kind of an apologetica for his actions. And Karl Barth wrote that wonderful declaration called the Barman Declaration, in which he affirms that there is only one Lord, and that one Lord is Jesus. And as he then turned his attention toward the study of the Gospels, and therefore his understanding of Jesus in the real world, we discover that Jesus, for Karl Barth, became one in whom God came to the far country of our existence. He began to think about Jesus as the vehicle by and through which the transcendent God interfaced and interacted with the human condition. And then he wrote this infamous sentence: "And it is no accident that Jesus, coming to the far country of our existence, was a Jew." For Karl Barth, the Judaism of Jesus is informative in terms of his impact upon life in the church. And what is that impact? Number one, Jesus as a Jew identified with the reality of humanity. That means that he experienced prejudice at the hand of Romans. It means that he stood in a tradition that had been harassed consistently throughout all of history. It also meant that Jesus was someone who understood pain and sadness and rejection. And above all else, for Karl Barth, Jesus as a Jew represented what Bernard Anderson has called the scarlet thread of salvation that wanders through all of the scriptures, so that Jesus as a Jew became the unique expression for Karl Barth of God's choice to save the world. In his work, Christology, Karl Barth makes this observation: because Jesus came as a Jew, we who follow Jesus must understand ourselves to be a servant people. Because as you do know, as you read the Old Testament, servanthood is an emerging theme within Judaism. Secondly, he also talked about the fact that it was important, as we follow Jesus, to realize that we are a pilgrim people. Even as Jews were constantly in search of the promised land, the wonder of Jesus for Karl Barth summons all of us as Christians to be about the journey toward the promised land. Not necessarily a geographical location, but perhaps a relational and existential location. Thus we see that Karl Barth, a Christian theologian, talks about Jesus as the one in whom God has come to the far country of our experience and identified with all of us, making all of us servants, and also calling us to be a pilgrim people. Keep those two words in mind, because at the conclusion of my comments, before we do a Q&A, I want to develop what that means for the contemporary church. The second theologian I'd like to talk about is Rosemary Ruther. She is a Catholic theologian. She is also clearly a person who's deeply committed to the issues of gender and primarily feminism. She grew up in a Catholic home. Her mom was a devout practicing Catholic. Her father died very young, and as her mother and she developed this close bond, part of that bond was Catholicity and how you practice it. And Rosemary Ruther's mother had been schooled by the Jesuits. And that meant that her mother had a terribly and wonderfully universal ecumenical concept of Catholicism. And she implanted and instilled that in this young child growing up. And then there was this. Rosemary Ruther's uncle by marriage, Uncle David, was a Jew. And he shared with Rosemary what it was like to be a Jew during the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. Not only in Germany, but in America. And he talked about the reality of prejudice. He talked about the reality of hostility. He talked about the reality of an exclusionary concept. And that too had an impact upon this emerging mind. And then she went off to Georgetown University. And there, the themes of a universal Catholicity married to a deepening personal understanding of Judaism and its history continued to shape her. And while it is true that Rosemary Ruther's theological effort has been directly linked to the issues of women's rights and feminism in the life of the church, it would be a mistake to think that it does not have other implications. Because her fundamental notion is that Jesus is a prophet. She underscores the enormous importance of prophecy in the life and the work of Jesus, which she maintains came from his reading of his scriptures, Isaiah, Jeremiah. And of course, she defines the word prophet. When we use the word prophet, usually what we mean is somebody who foretells the future. And certainly there's a component of that in the scriptures. But really, the translation of the Hebrew word nabi, which translates into prophet, has nothing at all to do with telling the future. It has to do with reading the signs of the times. And then based upon the reading of those times, beginning to make some critique and some suggestion concerning not only positive things, but also those things which may, in fact, breed hostility and even death. Beyond that, Rosemary Ruther talks about the fact that prophets, while concerned with the spirituality of life, and she says, the politics of heaven, prophets were fundamentally concerned about today and right now and this world of ours that we share together. And so Rosemary Ruther begins to make the case that as a prophet, Jesus was a feminist. And she does that by citing the fact that on Easter morning, it was not the guys who made the journey before dawn to the tomb. It was women. And likewise, she continues in that thought by suggesting it was women who brought back to the guys who were hiding, "He is risen." Rosemary Ruther also talks about the fact that Mary Magdalene is clearly an early leader in the life of the church. And along with Dr. Paget at Princeton University, reveals how it was that the early church, which was primarily a masculine concept in terms of leadership, ultimately were responsible for denigrating her and making her appear to be less than because she was a real threat as a leader. And therefore, Rosemary Ruther says, as a prophet, Jesus calls us to speak out against any kind of misogynistic behaviors. She calls them sins because they violate the sacred nature of life. But then Rosemary Ruther makes us aware that misogyny is only one concept of prejudice that produces hostility. And she says the kingdom of God comes whenever we look beyond gender, race, color, political persuasion, and certainly theological difference, and not only tolerate, but accept those who are different from us. She reminds us that Jesus, as a prophet, was proactive. Back in the day, not too many people spoke to lepers, excepting this carpenter from Nazareth. If you read the texts, Jesus one day finally says to his buddies, "Hey, fellas, guess what? We have to go to Samaria, because the Samaritans were at the bottom of the pecking order in that area of the world." Rosemary Ruther reminds us that Jesus was friend to tax collector. And she also reminds us that Jesus was not crucified between two candles. He was crucified between two thieves, to which he said to one of them, "Today, you will be with me in paradise." So that this feminist theologian reminds us that the prophetic tradition of Jesus as a Jew is as strong and as clear as Isaiah. "Thus saith the Lord." Or then again, Nathan, who went to King David and said, "David, you're the man," confronting the culture of their day with the need to deal with their sins. And then the third theologian is Dietrich Bonhoeffer. I don't know how you can talk much about 20th century and consequently 21st theological concepts without dealing with this man. If there's a watershed theologian anywhere, it has to be Bonhoeffer. Because while it is that many of his contemporaries, Barth, for example, ultimately had to flee to Switzerland, where he lived his whole life in Basel. Tillich had to flee to America, where he taught at Union and Notre Dame and Harvard. Bonhoeffer stayed. And his story is about how, as a student, his dissertation was based upon the fact that every Christian needed to be a dogmatician, and that only Scripture was the basis for faith, and how it was that the church needed to be a communion of acceptance. His story is about a teacher who went on radio and challenged Adolf Hitler with his concept of Das Führer, which means leader or lord. Bonhoeffer's story is about a pastor, a man who served German-speaking churches in England and left that safety to return to deal with the church in Germany. His story is about a reformer who initiated the underground seminary and tried to support and educate young pastors to have the resources and the means to stand against a mighty evil. And of course, his story is about a martyr who, just 5 days before the Allied forces emancipated Germany and Poland, Bonhoeffer was hung by the neck. And a man who observed that said he had never seen a man die with more courage. And as one looks at Bonhoeffer, student, teacher, pastor, reformer, martyr, one thing is clear. He was a Christ-centered theologian. It is true that Bonhoeffer went through varying stages of understanding who Jesus was in terms of function. And perhaps the most significant station that he observes, particularly toward the end of his life, is this. Jesus was a Messiah. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer defines and describes Jesus as Messiah, as a man for others. Bonhoeffer's faith in Jesus seems to be about not so much whether or not a person gets into heaven. It's much more a messianic message of how it is that a person is cared for and loved and supported in this life. There's a great story. It's, by the way, it's factual. Of Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his writing of that wonderful book, Letters and Papers from Prison. Yes, you're quite correct that it was brought together following his death. All of his works were. But in the Letters and Papers from Prison, there's one of the letters that he writes to his father. And it is toward the end of his imprisonment, and he is pining away to be home. And he talks with his father in this letter about his desire to be at home to care for God's people. Bonhoeffer was a pastor at heart. And then toward the end of that letter, he says, however, just yesterday, I, along with all of the other prisoners in the camp, went into the courtyard for the morning count. And as I was thinking and even praying, dear God, free me so that I can care for God's people, suddenly I realized who God's people were. They were the Jews over there, the dissidents over there, the gays over there, the disenfranchised and the political dissidents over there. And he ends that wonderful letter by giving thanks to God that he had been privileged to serve God's people in the tradition of Jesus the Messiah, a man who cared for others. And if you want to be careful, I like to be careful with this kind of thing because I think it takes a little poetic license here, but nevertheless, I think it would be wrong to think that Bonhoeffer was martyred to be somehow comparable to the death of Jesus. I don't think that's not the point. This is the point, which is made by Beth Age, who is one of his biographers. The same dynamics that put Jesus to death were comparable dynamics that put Bonhoeffer to death. Bonhoeffer didn't have any messianic concept. He just followed the Messiah. And as a result of that, he too was martyred. And I think that Bonhoeffer's understanding of Jesus really does expand the concept of Messiah. And it makes it almost a kind of universalism. Certainly a kind of ecumenical acceptance. So, we have these three lives. Karl Barth, pilgrim people, servant people. Rosemary Ruther, that's wrong. And we have Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a man for others, unconditionally. And what do we then glean from all of that? Well, I'm going to load you up with my biases. Okay? I better make a disclaimer here. These are clearly prejudices on my part. With Bart, I think the church needs to realize that we are a servant people. We're not called to be served. Just read the great poem of St. Francis of Assisi. Our fundamental task as a follower of Jesus is to be as a servant. And what that means, I think, in the context of the church, is to get over ourselves and get over our egos and to get over our selfish self-interests. I was sharing with some folks that I've been privileged to be at St. Vincent College now for a lot of years. And friends, good friends, who mean well, they say things to me like this all the time. Why do you go up there? Well, I'll tell you why I go up there. For the money. No, that's not true. No. Oh, God. I go up there because of these wonderful young people. And what makes them wonderful? Many things. Above all else, in my mind, you know something? They're not hung up on being right. And they're not hung up on being first. Let me illustrate that. We have a little Tuesday evening group. It's called What's on Your Mind. We have two rules. Nobody ever gets laughed at in that group. Never. Second rule is, what happens and is said there stays there. I'm not there to be the eyes of the administration. Now, with those two things in place, we have some pretty open discussions. And about a year ago, a young man by the name of Blaze began to come to the meetings. Blaze is autistic. And his autism is acted out in all kinds of bizarre gestures, attitudes, and practices. And for nearly 2.5 months, Blaise would always arrive late. Never took off his coat, never sat down, walked around the group doing this. Every kid at that table never spoke a word. And then one night, a young man whose name is Jim remembered that Blaise was studying environmental science, which was Jimmy's major. And as Blaise was walking around, Jimmy said to Blaise, "Hey, Blaise, what'd you think of class today?" And now when Blaise comes to our group, guess what? He takes off his coat. He sits down. He actually interacts. Not one kid in that group claims credit for that. They're just glad Blaise is there. Humorous note on that. Blaise really does talk now. It's almost a pain in the neck. You know what I'm saying? And Will Kuzik, who's been graduated and now works at the college, came to me one afternoon as a student afterwards, and he said, "Hey, Doc." He said, "You know, I'm happy Blaise comes. I'm glad he's part of the group. But when is somebody going to tell him to shut up?" That's servanthood. And I think that is what Bart's understanding of Jesus summons us to be. We don't have to be leaders. We don't have to get credit. In fact, maybe servanthood is the most significant form of leadership. Bonhoeffer had a wonderful word. It's a Greek word. It means parazon. And that word means unique, extraordinary, unusual. Isn't it unique and extraordinary and unusual when the church, as the servant of God in Christ, says to women, "Of course we'll ordain you." Or says to gays, "You're welcome here." Or says to persons of color, "How about undocumented workers? Come on in." We had an interesting experience at our house. Well, we have several. They're not all instructive, by the way. But we had some yard work done recently by a young man from in our area. And when he came to look at the work and give us an estimate, as he finished, he said, "I have a question to ask you." Listen to this question. It's haunting. "Do you mind if some of my workers who are Hispanic come on your property?" See, the church says, "Wait a minute. I'm not looking for their card. I'm looking to see they know how to use a shovel." That's what it means to be a servant. What about a pilgrim people? Well, a pilgrim people is an interesting thing to study, particularly in America. You know, our Puritan forefathers and mothers came here as pilgrims. They came here in search of religious freedom. They came here to be emancipated from the tyranny of the crown. And what's the first thing they did? They restricted religious freedom. They said to Quakers, "You're not allowed in here. You have to get out of Barbados." And they said to Catholics, "Yeah, you can be here, but you better stay in Rhode Island." Suddenly, this pilgrim people became an oppressor people. When we look at Jesus as a Jew, in terms of being a part of a pilgrimage, it quickly dissipates any arrogance we might have about having arrived. I once was given a little plaque that I still have. And this is what it said. "Please be patient with me. I'm a work in progress." You know something? Some of the most capable, significant people I know are works in progress. I have a dear friend and a mentor. Some of you may know him. His name is Bill Grove. He was pastor over at Christ Church for a number of years and then was made a bishop. Bill's now 87 years old, and he just celebrated 63 years of ordination recently. There's not an ounce of pride in that man. In fact, there is only humility and gratitude for life. We have a granddaughter down in Reading. Her name's Maria, and she puts out a monthly newsletter. If you'd like, I could make you a subscriber after I'm done here. It's pretty good for a 12-year-old kid. And Bill Grove, one day, I was talking to Bill, and I was tempted. He sent me a copy, so I did. Now he's a subscriber. More importantly, he and Maria have a relationship. And last fall, Babe and I, our daughter and Maria, drove down to Charleston, where Bill and Mary Lou live. And we had lunch together. It was one of the most beautiful moments you're ever going to see. Maria once asked him, "What should I call you?" He said, "Well, in my family, I'm known as Bishpo. That's the Spanish word for bishop. But," he said, "in my family, it doesn't mean bishop. It means grandpap." You get the point? This guy's done it. He's been a bishop of the church. And boy, is he a pilgrim guy. When we affirm Jesus as our Lord in the Bardian sense, I think those are some thoughts we need to have. What about Rosemary Ruther? Well, I think that the church has lost this prophetic awareness. Now, what I mean by that is this. I do not suggest, nor do I believe in, a prophecy that rises up out of anger or makes judgments about people or is harsh or certainly is uninformed. We have way too much of that. For me, prophecy is nabai, looking around, seeing the signs of the times, and then prayerfully beginning to try to address what we see. For me, prophecy is not about condemning someone, it's about liberating them. And we're seeing that, aren't we, with this wonderful Pope that the Catholic Church has. I'm thinking of switching over. I really am. The one thing that keeps me from doing that is my pension program. I don't want to lose that. So I'm thinking of becoming a closet Catholic. You know what I'm saying? Just show up every now and then. I'm just so enamored with this guy. What a spirit. Who am I to judge? And yet, you know his history. He doesn't wear the gold papal cross. He wears the iron one that was given to him in Venezuela. He doesn't wear the $800 red shoes either. He wears brown Oxford just like we do. He doesn't ride around in the limousine. In fact, when he went to meet Trump this past week, he arrived in a Ford Focus. He gets it. However, he's a prophet. If you doubt that, talk to some of the people who have been working in the Vatican Bank. He's saying, "I want to see a balance sheet. And I want to see it now. And I'll tell you what. You can go ahead and call me a grandpap if you like. I don't care. Get me the balance sheet." Well, they also had a German bishop who built himself a nice big residence. Bathtub in that residence cost 20,000 euros. Beep, boop, 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 beep, boop, boop. Hello. This is Francis. Sell the bathtub. Point being, Francis understands that you can be a gentle spirit and call out injustice. And I think that is where the church needs to be today. I think the church needs to be really mindful of the lingering realities of sexism and racism in our culture. Yeah, I know, we have women that serve in terms of the being executives of large institutions and corporate. I get that. But we also still know that women are underpaid for the same amount of work that a man does. And we also know that women are still perceived as sex objects, playthings, toys. We all have to realize that, and I'm very sensitive to this because I have a daughter and I have two granddaughters. And I want those three young women to grow up believing in themselves. I personally believe we have a tremendous problem dealing with people of other faiths, primarily the Muslim community. We need to be much more, I think, forthcoming and relational with our Muslim brothers and sisters. Because may I remind you that, yes, there are some radical fanatics out there, terrorists, who are Muslims. But there are also some good old boy Christians that are out there. They're pretty scary dudes. So I think we need to have deeper ecumenical conversations to realize, yes, we're different, but yes, we're the same. I think we have a real big issue with the question of homosexuality. I don't pretend to know the answer to that question, but I do think I know this. When a dear friend of mine, Jim, and his partner come to my house, they are welcome. And I very much treasure and prize that relationship. And as you may or may not know, my denomination is on the verge of a huge schism over the question of homosexuality. And lastly, I think we need to be concerned about some other concepts that aren't quite as controversial. I think I'm a little tired of seeing people of age become a market for the nursing home industry. I think I'm a little tired of seeing the working poor be abused. I think I'm a little tired of seeing the disadvantaged and the disenfranchised be neglected. And the church needs to become, in the spirit of Jesus, a prophetic voice. Not an angry voice, but a loving, caring voice. What time do you need to be out of here? 10, 30, or 20 up? Okay. I'll finish up and we can get out of here. You're starting to look like my students, you know. I don't mind people looking at their watch, but I really resent this. What about this Bonhoeffer guy and his concept of messianic traditions? Well, first of all, I think we need to be a people of salvation. We need to be a people who bring the evangelos, the good news. And the evangelos, the good news is not that everybody has to be a Christian. The good news is that the God of the universe, Yahweh, Allah, call God whatever you like, is a loving, benevolent, merciful God who invites us to be the same. We've lost our parents, and I have to admit that every now and then I think about hoping one day to see them again. You can laugh at me if you like, but I hold on to that concept. But I do need to give you a little bit of humor about that. My dad, who lived to be 88, when he was 84, had to have open heart surgery. Now, my father was not a poet. He was a mill worker. You get the point. And as we were waiting for the surgery to happen, he was in the hospital, and they had to have a minister at that time who had an enormous capacity to say the wrong thing. And so he came to see my father. And after some awkward moments, he finally said to my dad, "Well, John, look at it this way. If this surgery works and you get better, you can continue your life here on earth with all your friends." I'm thinking, that's a good thought. And then the infamous but. If it doesn't work and you die, you can go out to heaven and meet all your friends that are waiting for you. My dad gave him one of those looks that says, "You're done." And the minister left, and my father and I continued on in that stony silence which characterized our relationship. And finally my dad said to me, "Hey boy," that's what he called me all my life, "Hey boy, I got a question for you." "What's that, Dad?" He said, "Who in the hell do you think's out there waiting for me?" In spite of that, I still anticipate that moment. However, I worry about Malik. He's one of my students at the college. And boy, is that kid trying to get better and work. And I want for him to know the goodness of life. I worry about some of the people that I have known over the years that are now beginning to show some age. And that's not a funny issue, by the way. We're concerned about some of our friends who are having health issues and others that are having memory issues. Boy, I worry about them, and I want them to hear the good news. To follow Bonhoeffer's concepts of Jesus as a Jew, we must become a messianic people. Not only about heaven, but about relationship and quality of living here on earth. If you notice Bonhoeffer's life, his commitment to messianic behaviors cost him something. You know, he wrote a book entitled The Cost of Discipleship. And in that book, he said, the cost of discipleship is real. He lived that reality. Now, while it is that our messianic beliefs and commitments may indeed at some point cause us physical death, that's pretty much an outside reality and possibility. However, there are other costs. The cost, for example, of that's okay, you don't have to come to the meetings anymore. The cost in which friends suddenly begin to back away. The cost that can be associated with financial punitive behaviors. There are costs to discipleship and messianic behavior. We need to be willing to pay them and to be a suffering people, particularly with those who suffer more than we. And so, when I think about Jesus as a Jew, I think about a pilgrim people. I think about a servant people. I think about a prophetic voice. And most of all, I think about a messianic promise and hope that gives us assurance, commitments, and above all, victories in and for not only us, but for others. And that's all I have. So maybe you have some questions. Please.
The way black people were treated in this country with the way Jews and other marginalized people were treated in his country. And that really shaped his, to some extent, his life.
And to follow up on that, Bonhoeffer, in writing about that experience in Harlem with a man whose name was Harry Fisher, Bonhoeffer said of that experience that he, Bonhoeffer, learned what it was like to look from the bottom up. Now, I think that when we talk about marginalized people, we daresn't leave out people who are educated, who are affluent, who have health, etc. I think that's a grave mistake. When I was at First Church Pittsburgh, we had a number of families who lived in the Fox Chapel area, which is a very comfortable, lovely place. And I'll never forget a story I once heard told to me by one of those families. And it went like this. On a Friday evening, if they did not have some sort of a social commitment, they turned all the lights off in their house and went in the basement because they didn't want people to think that they weren't popular. I think that's being marginalized, don't you? So I think that when we talk about the marginalized of the world, certainly we must include the obvious. But I also think we should from time to time include the not so obvious, who in a kind of ironical way are treated with prejudice because they are educated or because they have some money or because they live in a nice house or whatever. They still may have the real need of that. And I suppose I'm assuming you're all aware of this, but you know, that we're having this terrible opioid epidemic in America. And in a piece in Christianity Today, which I received, there's an article dealing with the fact that historically we assume that drug addictions are among urban poor minorities. That's not true with this bugger. This is an epidemic that's affecting people who get their script from their doctor and abuse it. So I think we need to be very careful that we do not ironically marginalize people because they appear to be well. And beyond that, this is a rhetorical question, so don't answer it. Anybody here in the journey of your life that has never felt marginalized? Maybe you remember the day in gym class when, because you were the fat kid or the uncoordinated kid, you didn't get picked for the team. Or what about the day when you were a teenager so desperately hoping to be asked to the prom and weren't? Or what about the day in the office when you realized there was going to be an after-work party and you weren't invited? We've all been marginalized at some point. And the nature of, I think, the messianic experience is that we all need to be sensitive to that with each other. And when we are, the world gets better. Thanks for that reminder by Bonhoeffer. Other, yes, please, Ted.
Since you mentioned the opioid epidemic, I see a lot of things said, and I hear a lot of things said, and see a lot of things written about how quite possibly we are all kind of becoming more marginalized, more disconnected from be interested in your thoughts on how we might become better connected.
You're not going to like me for this. I think the first thing we got to do is put our phones away. And I think the second thing we ought to do is turn off our computer. And the third thing we ought to do is stop being connected on LinkedIn and call each other. So I think one of the major crises in our culture today for me, and it's just my observation, is the technological advances we have made that unfortunately have not been... We've made the technological advances without making the ethical advances that were necessary to use them appropriately. I am not arguing against the internet. That's silly. It's a wonderful tool. When I began to preach 45 years ago, I had to write 3 manuscripts on those yellow legal pads. Now I can write a manuscript and I go back in there and I can rework that bugger. And I think, well, maybe after today's presentation you may not agree, but I think I'm a better preacher today than I was 45 years ago because of that tool, obviously. But Ted, I think we are increasingly marginalized and separated from each other. Number two, in addition to the internet, phone, computer question, I think we have to begin to think about the relationship between tolerating each other and accepting each other. And I don't think we spend enough time doing that. We think we're okay if we tolerate each other. That really doesn't make it. Because if you think about toleration, that implies that I don't really like you. So I'm going to have to tolerate you. I think we have to build a strong acceptance of that a concept of each other. Three, and you're really not going to like this one. I think we have to move away from religion. And we have to be embraced. Hear that? We need to be embraced by spirituality. And when that happens, we discover that in war, black, brown, yellow, white, red, doesn't matter. We all bleed the same. And whether you're making 500 grand a year or 20,000 a year or whatever you're making, you know, the thing that links us together is trying to care for our kids. And whether you're a Presbyterian or a Methodist or a Catholic or a Muslim, for most of us, the ultimacy of faith is what the old psalmist talked about. When I walk through the valley of shadow of death, you are with me. So I think if we could get beyond the institutionalization of ideas, primarily about God and Jesus and Yahweh and Allah and all the rest of it, and begin to talk about the spirituality of life, we could have a shot at it. And a footnote on that response. I think we're doing that. The young people I know say things like this. You know, I'm so sick and tired of my roommate being on their phone all the time. In fact, at the college, our seniors this year picked up on something that one of our faculty members does regularly. When he sees a kid coming down the hallway and he has those earbuds in, this is what he does. Because immediately the kid thinks he's lost his hearing. And when you see the kid coming down the hallway like this, you get right in his path, and you hopefully knows each other. So our seniors and our juniors are saying, have you noticed how kids, these freshmen don't know how to communicate? I'll tell you something else about our young people today. They don't see black. They don't see Protestant. They don't see Catholic. They don't see gay. You know what they see? Bill. Mary. How are you? So I think it would be a mistake to think that we are living in some sort of a post-era. I have just the opposite opinion. I think we're living on the cusp of some really significant breakthroughs, relationally, because the current, this is a prejudice, I think the current level that we're on relationally, I mean, look at it, our divorce rates are up, our violence rates are up. This is not sustainable. It's not sustainable. And sometimes our young people are ahead of the curve in terms of the rest of us. Anybody else want to offer a comment or critique or question? Well, you've been very kind to have me back. I think I'm coming in December for something, and we'll figure out what that's going to be later on. Have a good day.